Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. So start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Today's show is also sponsored by Howl.fm, Howl.fm. It's like Netflix for podcasts, and with Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to a brand new Howl Comedy original series called The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium, which is not going to mean much to you until I tell you that it's made by and stars Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, who is freaking hilarious. And you get a bunch of other stuff, over 120 hours of new Howl original miniseries and audio documentaries like The Complete Woman, Finding the Funny with the Sklar Brothers, and Fruit, all the archives from WTF with Marc Maron, and all Earwolf shows like Comedy Bang Bang, How Did This Get Made, and this one. So get access to all this exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, and on the web for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code CRACKED, you get a full month free trial. To redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account on the web at howl.fm, and yeah, enter the code CRACKED at checkout. That's howl.fm and use promo code CRACKED. The internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and you're listening to Chasing Shadows by Santigold, which is a song that uses the words I or I'm 25 times, which, weird thing to notice, I'll admit. But this week we're talking about narcissistic personality disorder, and I'll explain what counting the number of times a musician says I in a song has to do with that. But first of all, it's important to establish what we mean when we say narcissism. So we're not talking about a smug person or a person who thinks they're great. So according to doctors, people with narcissistic personality disorder can't connect with other human beings. They can't feel love for other people and can't feel loved by other people, and therefore desperately try to fill that emptiness where normal people have love and empathy with the symptoms of love, you know, sex, admiration, self-confidence, success. They're basically a spiritually poor person who is pretending not to be, you know, like an old-timey con man. I'll call it a self-esteem Ponzi scheme a couple times. Now, a person who feels worthless and is conscious of their feelings of worthlessness is depressed. But if you tell a narcissist that they feel worthless and unloved, they'd tell you you're crazy. And they'd actually believe that you're crazy and wrong. The feelings of worthlessness are happening below the surface. And, you know, it's not important that you get all of this right now. The only thing I really need you to get right out of the gate is that in the context of today's conversation, the narcissist is someone who's suffering, who really we should feel sorry for, and not just a cocky person who pays a lot of attention to their appearance. But so the reason we're talking about it today is because Jason Pargin and I both have independently gotten the same idea that as a culture and as a people, we're becoming more narcissistic, and that this shift is kind of crucial to understanding a lot of the big important events that have happened in the past few years. I quote a statistic that 1% of the general population suffers from this disorder, which is what it says in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition. So it's often cited as the DSM-IV, which I think came out in 2000. But anyways, they're the experts, but that doesn't seem right to me anymore. And one of the questions we're going to be talking about today is whether it's actually higher in today's America. Yeah, we'll be using that phrase a lot, in today's America, and talking about Joe the plumber. But we'll be wondering if it's actually higher than that in our world, or if it just seems like that because the people who become famous and dominate our TVs and, you know, the friends of ours who dominate our social media timeline are more likely to have narcissistic personality disorder. Are the mass media and social media warping the world to look more full of narcissists? Or is the world becoming more full of narcissists because of mass and social media? But the reason I was counting the eyes in that song is because there was a study by a guy named Nathan DeWall a few years back that found a statistically significant increase in the number of times the words me and I occur in song lyrics compared to songs from the 70s and 80s, which were more likely to be about us and we, you know, we are the world. And I remember hearing that and being generally embarrassed for the soft sciences and every one of us who spent money on a liberal arts education. But lately, I've had a theory of my own kind of brewing in the back of the old bullshit factory that we've been increasingly okay with singers with shitty voices and, you know, people talk singing. Like, I love Fetty Wap, but he seems to be a new low when it comes to vocal performances we're willing to define as singing. And my theory was that it had something to do with us wanting to be the singer, the same way that we're no longer okay getting our news from Dan Rather. Now we want to be involved in the news on social media. And going broader in music, we're less interested in going to watch a really skilled classical musician achieve a level of skill that we'd have to have trained from age 4 to achieve. And we're more interested in going to watch a DJ do something we secretly think we could do if we downloaded the right software. It's the same idea that American Idol is based on. The reality televisionizing of every type of media. Anyways, I was thinking about these theories that there's something inherently narcissistic about the direction music is headed last week because Kanye West released an album that I loved, as you know if you listened to last week's podcast. But then he spent the week following its release just distracting everyone from his own album, almost like he saw the attention turning to this incredible album he created and just couldn't bear to give up the spotlight. And so I did what I often do when I'm thinking about a subject, and I searched the New Yorker's archive, a great magazine that's had the best writers in the world writing thoroughly fact-checked nonfiction for about a century now, so pretty great resource for research. Anyways, I entered the words narcissistic personality disorder into the search box, and the second result was a 2011 update to a 1997 profile of Donald Trump. And that's when I realized that I might be onto something with the music thing, and that narcissism might be the answer to more than one question about our culture that I've been wanting answers to. By the way, the Trump question is not, why do these crazy assholes like Donald Trump, because I totally see the appeal, as we'll discuss. But 4 years ago, he was laughed out of the presidential race. So yeah, the question is more what's changed. Reading the profile, you get the sense that he hasn't changed since 1997 and that he may in fact be incapable of change. So something about us is different. And you know, when you take a step back and look at culture in the right way, you can see this rare and painful personality disorder all over our culture in the rise of reality TV, the rise of Facebook, which allows us to executive produce a reality show about our lives. Basically, every major trend over the past decade can at least partially be blamed on a shift towards narcissism if you squint and tilt your head just right. So that's what we're talking about. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Maybe I will get it wrong, no baby for myself. Selling his ideas till I'm older, living on the shelf. I won't follow him taking a long way if my standards hold me up. Why they eating their idols up? Now why they eating their idols up? Damn it, I give my I'm joined on the phone by Jason Parjan, who writes on the site as David Wong, best-selling novelist. How's it going, Jason?
It's going well. And if we have new listeners who don't really know who I am or who Jack is, basically, if Cracked was like the Batman versus Superman universe, which I know nobody's seen the movie, but you've seen the commercials already, I'm the equivalent of Superman, like the person with godlike power who's sort of gone insane with that power. And then Jack would be the equivalent of Zack Snyder, the guy behind the scenes who is secretly ruining everything.
I can't believe you picked my favorite director. Thank you. Thank you, Jason. That's exactly right. And also, I have his subtlety and eye for symbolism. So today we're talking about a bunch of things, but I think the kind of main thesis that I wanted to at least start with is this idea that our culture has been overtaken by a personality disorder. The narcissism personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, is how it's listed in the psychiatric handbook that everybody always cites and that I'm drawing a blank on.
Isn't your wife a doctor, Jack?
Yeah, I don't read Grey's Anatomy. Is that a book or is that a TV show? I forget. Anyways, so the idea being that it's this rare personality disorder that for a variety of reasons, it's sort of like a glitch in the social contract, and it's now become sort of our status quo. I think the stat is that in general, it's like 1% of any culture actually lives by these values. And we'll talk about what it is in particular, but just in terms of the overall dynamic, 1% of people have this very horrible and hellish existence as sufferers from narcissistic personality disorder. But it is now sort of the values that we have accepted as our shared cultural values. And it seems like it might be something new.
Yeah, and I think a good place to start, you know, the word narcissist or narcissism is tricky because it's both like a clinical diagnosis and an insult. Like, it's a term that experts use, but it's also a term people use in everyday conversation. But, you know, because if you say, yeah, I dated this guy, he turned out to be a total narcissist, that's just another way of saying he was a jerk. You know, he's an egotistical jerk. So to understand what we're talking about, you kind of do have to step back and look at exactly what the definition is, because what I'm going to do is read off like what the criteria are, and what's going to happen is like 90% of our listeners are going to say, that's me. But it's obviously a matter of degrees when you talk about the clinical sense, but when you talk about how it affects society and like why modern society tends to favor these people, it'll start to become a clearer picture. So I just want to kind of take a couple minutes and walk through. Anybody who's listening to this, if they go and Google what is a narcissist, you're going to get a checklist that says you have to meet most of these criteria. You're somebody that has a grandiose sense of self-importance, a preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, ideal love, a belief that you're special and unique and that you can only be understood by, or you should only associate with other special people. Kind of think about like the main character in American Psycho. You have a sense of entitlement. You take advantage of others to achieve your own ends. You see other people as machines just to give you pleasure. You lack empathy. You're envious of others or believe that others are envious of you. You are arrogant or have haughty attitudes or behaviors. And the last one, you have a need for excessive admiration. And that last one is going to be key to what we're talking about. Because a narcissist, the whole deal is they don't connect with other human beings on like an equal level. Like, they have trouble building personal relationships. They don't want to be liked. They want people to be in awe of them. They want to be feared. They want to be whatever the word. So because they can't live up to the fantasy of being something people should awe, they pour all of their energy into appearances, into managing a public perception of themselves. There's a psychiatrist I've quoted a few times on this podcast who blogs anonymously at thelastpsychiatrist.com, and he compared it to living life in a glass box. Other people can see you, they can admire you, but they can't touch you. You can't connect with them. And so a narcissist is someone like they can't genuinely care about the environment, for instance, but they will make big, flashy, showy signs of care. They'll drive the right car. They'll be seen buying the right brands. But once they're alone, they couldn't care less. When they pick their mate, he's now looking for the girl that's actually going to be compatible with him or make him happy. He's looking for the girl that will impress other people. I walk into the room, all heads turn toward us, and the entire purpose of having her is for them to say, wow, what an amazing guy he must be to get her. So everything is focused outward. The premise is that in modern society, because we are all public figures to a degree now, just based not just social media, but just the way the world is, narcissists simply have more practice at managing public opinion of themselves and now have like a natural advantage or incentive to keep doing what they're doing.
Just going back to the baseline definition of what a narcissist is, a lot of the things that you mentioned, if you added that onto a description of somebody who is otherwise healthy, they could be profiles of, you know, mostly mentally healthy people and even people who society needs and who you would want to hire or add to your company. But the main thing that kind of crystallized it for me is that it's based on a kind of belief that you are defective. It's like a self-esteem Ponzi scheme. And we'll eventually get to the fact that Donald Trump really fits this definition to an amazing degree. So if you're trying to picture a narcissist, imagine going to Donald Trump and saying, you're a narcissist. He'd probably be like, of course, you know, I have a high opinion of myself. And then you'd say, no, it actually is compensating for this deeply held feeling of inferiority. You know, he would be like, what the hell are you talking about? Which is why clinically it's thought of as one of the most difficult disorders to deal with. You can't really help narcissists, or you have to do it very patiently and persistently to kind of get them to come around, and usually only after some manner of crisis has revealed to them, oh, wait, not all is right here. I have built up this kind of facade that's focused on the outside and is using outward indicators of success and value. Like you said, a good-looking spouse or money and looks, having good looks yourself, which is where it comes into sort of that stereotypical looking at yourself in the mirror all the time. But they need to use that. It's like they have to use those outward things because there's no inner life. There's no inner self that they feel like they can hang their sort of identity on. And so it's really this thing that is coming from a place of desperation, and that just happens to the way that our society has evolved. And maybe it's not an accident. I'll talk about maybe why it's not an accident, but it seems like it is exactly the perfect personality disorder to have, to the point that I even wonder if it should be thought of as a personality disorder in America today.
I really want to make sure the listener understands that point you made there, because the reason narcissist is an insult is because, like in an 80s movie, the narcissist, the evil boyfriend or the bully, it's a really tanned and muscular, good-looking dude who just preens in the mirror. And it's an insult because it's like, well, this is just an objectively bad person. It's just a jerk. It's an egomaniac. And what you described is what most people don't understand. In the article that I wrote in the wake of Robin Williams' suicide, I described that certain people, especially people that develop like a really advanced sense of humor, from the formative years on, they will build like a false self to put out there. I've since been informed that I probably stole that entire idea from Marc Maron, who says on his podcast like that he built a clown to go out there and take the abuse for him. So you build this false personality or whatever, but the reason narcissists are so miserable is because when someone shows love to the clown, it's like, well, they don't love me. They love the clown. So if you go out and you're posturing and you're very fake and you're very whatever, when people show you affection, it never reaches you because, like, well, they don't love me. They love this fake version of myself I'm being all the time. If they knew me, they'd run away screaming. The word narcissist comes from a parable of the story of Echo and Narcissus. And, like, it was a guy who was punished by the gods to stare into his reflection in a pond, I think, forever. Like, to become obsessed with his own reflection until he just starved to death on the shore of this pond. But that was a punishment. Like, that was his curse. You weren't supposed to, like, walk around envious of this guy. It's like, that was a sad thing that had happened to him.
So this is a thing that has existed for a long time. Like, I think that Greek myth is, like, set in the 1970s, at least, like, way long time ago. No, but it's a thing that's existed for a long time. But I've had these kind of moments of clarity in the last 7 years where I'll be like, oh, that feels like it is a thing that is designed specifically for narcissists. Like, Facebook seemed to me, when it first came out, like, that seems like a tool specifically made by and for narcissists, people who will endlessly post pictures of themselves and updates about themselves and who want to star in their own reality show enough for them to build a reality show on a web page about them and their life. And obviously not everybody uses it like that, but the people who are most conspicuous on Facebook seem to have that compulsive need to affirm their own awesomeness with pictures of what they're doing or whatever. So that was one moment of clarity I had where I was like, oh, are we getting more narcissistic or am I just an old man? But I do think that the fact that Trump is now a serious presidential candidate is, I think, an interesting landmark in social narcissism that's probably not totally unprecedented, but it does feel like there used to be a sense that you had to at least have a inner strength or, like, the ability to be unflappable. Like, you would want a leader who had a thick skin. You could insult them and then they would just be like, yeah, whatever. And now it seems like Trump is the right person for this moment in time, in the same way that Kanye West, his personality makes him kind of the right person for this exact moment, because that seems to be what society is built for. And, like, Trump, we had Robert Evans read every book Donald Trump has written, because I'm a cruel person, and he noticed the worst thing that he can possibly imagine happening to him is being laughed at. And that's, like, a textbook narcissistic personality trait. And if you follow Kanye West at all, you know, like, my experience with Kanye West is that I love his music and then I kind of cringe through all of his many outbursts and kind of meltdowns. And some of the more embarrassing moments are when, like, South Park made fun of him or Saturday Night Live made fun of him and he just could not take it at all. And it just seems like more and more these people are no longer out of step with the world around them and, in fact, are perfectly in step. They are marching to the beat that everybody else is drumming.
I guess what Donald Trump is, all of those traits in his personality, I feel like there was a time when we used to recognize, oh, this is a impulsive kind of dumb person. Forget about his politics, forget about his policies. The fact that he goes on Twitter and, like, gets in insult wars with random critics, the fact that he will start just, like, belittling people in, like, cheap and petty ways and, like, mocking them physically, like, those are traits of somebody who is a dumb, impulsive person. They're an immature, like, it's someone who made money early and hasn't had to mature since then. They haven't had to grow up, because who does he have in his life to tell him you need to grow up, right? So it's that sign of a stunted person. You wouldn't hire this person to, like, work at your shop. You wouldn't want to be around them. You wouldn't. So all of those traits that used to be seen as, like, objectively repulsive, I don't know. I don't know if we sympathize more with it or if we just look at him and it's like, hey, that's me too. I also do that. It's almost sad. Like, I think yesterday, or maybe it was even earlier today, there was some producer came out and said something about Kanye West. They wrote, it was like one producer from the 80s wrote an article where he thought that Kanye's music wasn't all that influential. And so Kanye, of course, rattles off like 75 consecutive tweets screaming about this guy, and then also noting at the end of each one, but I don't let the critics get to me. It's like, yes, you do. You're a billionaire, and you spent all day on your phone answering one guy who wrote like a blog post or something that otherwise nobody would have noticed, but you just couldn't take there being one voice out there. And the same thing with Donald Trump's position, that he wants to go to war. He wants to send young American men and women to die because, you know what, Iran's out there. They're laughing at us. Well, they won't be laughing at us once I'm president. I'll tell you that right now. It's like he wants to send people to die because they're laughing at us, because they don't take us seriously. It's like, you know, wars are over pieces of land and resources and actual tangible things, you know, displacing governments or freeing people or whatever nefarious purpose you have. But national prestige or international prestige is not a good reason to send people to die. That's not a good reason to kill 100,000 civilians with bombs, which is what's going to happen if we go to war. No matter who we go to war with, 100,000 civilians are going to die. But yet you have a solid like 35 or 40% of the population, at least at the primary level, saying, yeah, that's right, that's right. You know, we'll see who's laughing now. And it's like, yeah, you're right. It's like he's found all of his narcissists, all of these fragile egos.
Well, we can talk about the fact that we're both sitting here. We think we're important enough to be, rather than the ones who are listening to other people, we're the individuals who we think thousands of people should be listening to what we say.
Yeah, we're making 150,000 people listen to our private conversation about this subject. So yes, right. I wrote the Robin Williams thing from a first-person point of view. There's a reason I've spent my entire life reading about narcissism. It's not a casual interest of mine.
Right. And even with Trump, there is something, when I watch the Republican debates, he is the most compelling candidate to me, just on a very surface level, in the way that he mocks other people, and the way that it borders on being clownish. But before I started paying attention to the dynamic and his actual appearances, I was like, what's going on? Why are these people following this buffoon? And when I watch him, and I can't explain why it is, but there's something that has changed within me with the rest of the country where I'm like, oh, I get it. He's entertaining, and there's something about him that I want to listen to. Granted, I don't necessarily want to put him in charge of a nuclear arsenal, but I kind of get it. And I think that maybe what's happening, and we can talk about a bunch of other examples of where we're seeing this, like why the financial crisis can be seen as the outcome of a narcissistic personality disorder, like writ large in the entire industry. But it feels like there's sort of this amplification process, because like we said at the beginning, it's only supposed to be 1% of the population that has this disorder. But that 1% of the population are the people who are going to be most driven. Like, the people who become famous are not the most mentally healthy people. And there's this belief that I had had growing up that, wow, fame really does crazy stuff to people. And I think it's actually that to get famous, you have to want to be famous, and you have to pursue that end 24 hours a day. That needs to be your goal constantly. And in order for that to be true of you, you have to be pretty high on the narcissism personality disorder scale, which, by the way, is something everybody can go take if you're curious where you fit on the sort of gradient. But it feels like the people who we put in front of cameras and who put themselves in front of cameras, it's sort of a sampling error where the people who we look at are the people who are going to be the most narcissistic in a society. Let's say there were a dozen people born with the same amount of money as Donald Trump and have had the same business success as Donald Trump throughout the course of their career. The one that we're going to know about is the one who has this really debilitating personality disorder that makes them constantly put their name on things and constantly brag about how great they are and how much better than everybody else they are. It's almost like a glitch in the matrix of society that is causing us to build our entire society now in the image of this really minor disorder that used to only affect 1% of the population. And I do think that Hitler was also a narcissist, and we can talk a little bit about that too. There are extreme circumstances when this becomes incredibly attractive to people. Blood is sitting in my hands. I'll never be the bigger man. I know they'll never understand, but they don't give a fuck. Lift your hands up high before I stick you up. Hey guys, we're listening to Smoke and Retribution by Flume, who we've played before, remixed with Biggie. This is a song he actually released with my favorite current rapper, Vince Staples, called Smoke and Retribution. Hope you enjoy it and enjoy these words from our sponsors. Tell me you're afraid of disappointing, pushing on your physical existence. Pushing only cause you felt resistance. Can't help but think about the situation. This episode of the Cracked Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. You guys, building a website is hard stuff. The first webpage ever was launched on August 6th, 1991. And it was a blank white page with informational text. So yeah, if you wanted to recreate that website for whatever reason, you could probably figure that out on your own. But if you want to build a modern looking website for yourself, your business, your improvisational barbershop quartet, you'll want to check out Squarespace.com. Squarespace provides easy to build websites that look professionally designed regardless of your skill level. You can even add an online store to your site, and all websites designed through Squarespace scale beautifully and automatically to any mobile device. So for only $8 a month, you get all that plus 24/7 online support and a free domain name if you buy the service for a full year. So what are you waiting for? Start your free trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, use the offer code CRACKED, which is spelled C-R-A-C-K-E-D, to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Cracked Podcast. We thank Squarespace for their continued support of the Cracked Podcast and recommend to you Squarespace. You should. I ain't scared of 6 feet, cause I ain't scared to be free. All I seen while on this earth, know that hurts can't be too worse. Tell the woman that I hurt. I apologize for my lies and tell my mama blame my karma. Hey, she had to see me die. I just wanna see the sky.
Let's rewind a little bit and give a kind of a brief history lesson to explain how we've evolved here. I want to just go back to the beginning of time. I wrote an article many years ago about Dunbar's number. It's my article is called What is the Monkey's Fear? But it is about the fact that the human brain, because we evolved as a tribal type society, that our brains are wired to manage about 150 social connections. In other words, you can look at different species of primate and look at the size of the groups, the herds they form. I don't know what a group of monkeys is. It's a tribe or whatever it is. And you can see like the part of their brain that manages social connections. It's when that's bigger, they have bigger groups, which makes sense because you've got to keep track of people, right? You got to keep track of relationships. And with humans, if you compare them to other brains, our ideal size should be about 150, which makes sense because a city is a very modern invention, right? Like there were people who lived in ancient Rome, but a tiny, tiny fraction of the world lived in Rome. Everybody else lived in a little village or in a town. And so for the vast majority of our evolution, since we had no mass media and we had no ability to travel great distances, the vast, vast majority of us dealt with small groups, villages, a church congregation, right? About 150 people. So obviously in the modern age, you reach the Industrial Revolution, the urbanization of the world, that happens very, very rapidly. And then mass media comes along, first newspapers and then broadcast media in just, you know, the 1900s. And that changes everything radically. The number of social connections you have to maintain explode, because now you can find yourself, you've got a church congregation, but you're also working in a factory of 200 people. You also are in a city where you're in a building with a bunch of neighbors on every side of you. And then you also have mass media and all of these personalities entering your life. These celebrities, these famous people, these fictional characters are real people. When you're following their life and you're sympathizing with them, if you're keeping track of whether which of the Kardashians is pregnant or whatever, that's one of your social connections. Your brain is maintaining that as if they were one of your friends, right? So the idea is that over time, as we live more and more in public, there reaches a tipping point where, of course, Hitler had to manage himself as if he was a celebrity. Of course, Napoleon did the same thing. You know, of course, he carefully crafted how he dressed. You'll practice his hand movements in front of a mirror. You'll practice his voice. But today, you're almost at a point where everybody has to do that, where everyone has to kind of shape how they are. Like, the type of social pressure you're getting is a little bit different.
Can we just stop and explain the Hitler thing? Because we've definitely covered it on the site, but I don't think people know that about Hitler. Like, people think that he was good at speaking to crowds, which he was, and made use of, you know, you talk about technological innovations that created the mass media. The inventor of the loudspeaker went to his grave thinking that he was responsible for the rise of Nazism, and a lot of people at the time agreed. Because, like you said, prior to the invention of the loudspeaker at the beginning of the 20th century, you could only reach the number of people that could fit into the room that you were standing in front of. And then the loudspeaker is invented, and suddenly fascism rises up all over Europe. And a detail that gets kind of written out of the history of Adolf Hitler, because we're busy turning him into human history's Darth Vader, is there are all these pictures of him that you should go Google image search of him behind the scenes practicing for his speeches in front of a mirror, practicing his hand gestures, making these really carefully constructed facial expressions, like all of that stuff that looked wild and unrehearsed when he was giving speeches, down to the micro gesture, were planned out. Because Hitler was completely obsessed with himself, his own image, to the point that he was basically years and years ahead of his time in how narcissistic he was and how much he was like a Kardashian. He was thinking about controlling his image before anybody had invented the term public relations or like a PR agency. And so he was on the scale of, like, if the narcissistic scale goes up to 30, he was a 30. So I do think that combining with the invention of mass media, it's an interesting way to read that part of history. And by the way, the Kardashians are multiple of my friend groups, not just one of them.
I mean, you can rewind through history. And in general, if someone shows up in your history book, it's because they were a little bit of a showman, right? Like, well, we've talked on the site before, like Thomas Edison, the difference between him and other inventors is that you know his name because he put his name on everything. And same thing, like Nikola Tesla, like he was a showman. He crafted his image and he could really get himself out there and do these public demonstrations that would get the newspapers involved. There are many, many, many more, far more influential inventors than Edison, than Albert Einstein. Pick all the names you know. Those people you know, they were all showmen. They all, Albert Einstein knew he had wild hair. He knew he looked very memorable. And I remember with Mark Twain even, and everyone I think listening to this, when I say Mark Twain, you can get a picture of Mark Twain in your head. The white suit and like a bolo tie and the hair and the mustache. Like, okay, when he started writing books, what happened was Mark Twain got talked into doing a speaking tour to support one of his books and reluctantly did it. Came back from that. He said he made so much money that he made more money talking to people than writing the book. So he just crafted this public speaker celebrity version of himself, the way he dressed, the way he carried himself, he just write notebooks full of these little witticisms, and he became this celebrity where other authors of the day, you may know their names, you don't know what they looked like. So through history, the people who are good at manipulating public opinion have always sort of tended to bubble to the top. So you reach the mass media era and you get into, and we've mentioned on previous podcasts, like the show Mad Men about the ad agency in the 50s and 60s leading up to the early 70s when I think it ends. That show is about how America became narcissist because of these advertising agencies basically realized that you're not selling the car. You're selling what type of person these people want to project themselves as being. That in the post-World War II years, when the baby boomers, you know, started to grow up, or when people returning from the war, like that with the mass media, with commercial culture, like these people basically started saying, you want to drive a Lincoln, not because it's a good car. You want to drive a Lincoln because you want everyone else to see you driving a Lincoln and to think, wow, that's a Lincoln driver right there. He must be successful and wealthy and have a beautiful wife and all that. And started selling products based on playing to people's narcissism, bringing it out of them, saying, you want to wear these clothes, wear these shoes, eat this food, drink this beer, because this is the beer that Americans drink, or this is the beer that the educated people drink. And it's all made by the same company. It doesn't matter. They figured out that it's all in the ad campaign. And so we had also mentioned that you get up into the 70s and 80s, and another unexpected thing happens, which is the invention of no-fault divorce, which caused the divorce rate to skyrocket, creating a generation of kids who grew up, and I know I'm repeating a whole speech that Tyler Durden gave in Fight Club, but a whole generation that grew up either without fathers or without mothers, but grew up kind of having this, and you can see it play out in like every sitcom in the 80s and 90s, having this need for validation, for unconditional love that they weren't getting at home because they were from a broken home. So you have, on top of everything else now, a generation of people who now, A, need validation more than ever before, B, have marketing types and commercials telling them how to get it, specifically by owning this, wearing this, eating this, going to this restaurant, whatever. And then come the 90s and the 2000s when the internet and social media comes along, now you have a stage and you reach a point where now, if you interviewed kids in the 1930s, asked them what their first goal in life would be, like most of them, it would be something like to raise a family, to meet a wife or a husband that loves me. A select few would be like to get rich. Now a solid like 40 or 45% say is to get famous. And that used to not be a thing, but like kids legitimately grow up thinking they're going to be famous because they're in a culture where A, they need that validation from strangers, and B, it's being reinforced in every direction because all of our heroes do it. You know, all of the ads and products, everything appeals to it.
It's interesting. First of all, Twain and Einstein, do you think that they just like went into barbershops and were like, all right, just give me the genius. Give me the genius haircut.
Know.
Like it seemed like in order to take the idea of Twain and turn him into Einstein, all I need to do is change his white coat to a gray lab coat, and obviously they looked very different, but not that different. Yeah, Twain had a little bit more hair.
Another example is Steve Jobs and his jeans and that black turtleneck. You don't think that's specifically crafted? If you don't think that was a specific decision he made to brand himself, so when you walk, like, because he's otherwise a normal looking, like you wouldn't recognize him, but the fact that he always wore the same thing, the glasses, the black, like, that was distinct and it was branding.
That's also a good example of somebody who rose to the height of our culture and was a great tinkerer, I think is how Malcolm Gladwell describes him. He was great at tweaking different aspects of other people's designs. Like that's kind of the best skill that you can possibly have right now. But he was stealing a lot of other people's ideas. And when you kind of take a step back, the main thing that he unified his outlook on the world is that he was like, no, I should have that idea. You know, like, that should be making me famous, not that person. And I think that he was a genius and had a great design sense, but maybe there were two other guys who were as brilliant and had the same design sense as him, but he was the more narcissistic, and therefore he becomes Steve Jobs. You were talking about the no-fault divorce thing. I think it could be that it just started with the creation of the mass media at the beginning of the 20th century, and everything we're seeing is just sort of a feedback loop where it's all circling back on itself. And so the baby boom generation, like our parents, were seen as the me generation when they came around, and like the most selfish generation ever. And now, you know, they think that our generation is narcissistic, and our generation is already freaking out about how narcissistic millennials are. And I just wonder if it's not all going back to the invention of the loudspeaker. The power has been taken away from the crowd to decide, hey, let's all go over there. That guy has a really interesting thing to say. And now part of the equation becomes whether that person thinks that hundreds of thousands of people should be listening to what they say. And from there, it's like, okay, now everybody is looking at a narcissist and listening to the words of a narcissist. And so his worldview nudges things a little bit in that direction. Every famous person who you listen to or, you know, read the ideas of, you can't help but let some of that in. And so because of just that one invention and the idea of mass media that kind of flows from that one invention, you could almost view it as a inevitable evolution of society towards becoming more and more narcissistic.
From my own point of view, and I'm not speaking as any kind of an expert academically, I'm saying from my own life, everyone thinks they want to be famous. Okay, everyone sees someone standing up in front of a crowd and thinks, I would do anything, like that would be amazing to have a bunch of people shouting that they love you. The reality of it is, what you're getting from the crowd, it's like a sugar high as opposed to like something that actually nourishes you. As a human being, you evolve to need certain things from other human beings. We're social animals. So when I talk about love, even if you, like, this is a scientific thing, like you need certain affection, certain bonds you need to form with friends, with mating partners, whatever. The version of it you get from the crowd doesn't fill those holes. It feels great in the moment, and it only makes you want more of that. But when it doesn't fill the hole, you think, well, I need a bigger crowd. That's the issue. You know, well, I know why I'm so depressed. It's because that last album, it didn't sell as much. And it's like, no, you're getting depressed because over time you're realizing this isn't doing anything for you. It's not sex. It's masturbation. It's a sugar rush. You know, you're going to be hungry again 5 minutes later. So it still looks very good from the outside, and people will always want to pursue it. And it will always look great to people that don't have it, because people, again, don't get that attention. It's the same thing as guys think that the best thing in life to be would be like a really beautiful woman. Like, they're the royalty of this world because every day they've got 13 guys on the subway telling them they're beautiful. And it's like, I'm telling you, if you could do a body switching thing, that like 1 month of that, you would realize why they get sick of it. So when you hear celebrities complaining about the paparazzi or whatever, it's very easy to just like, well, you know, it's what you expect. You know, you're starring in a bunch of movies. And it's like, well, if you don't have it, then you're never going to feel sorry for these people. Because it's like, yeah, it's really nice getting things. It is nice getting things for free. You're making tons of money. Like, because you could easily say to any of these celebrities, well, look, if you want to stop being famous, all you got to do is just take a job, go move to Mexico and work on a farm somewhere. Like, they're not going to be famous there. And obviously, they never take us up on it. So some of them manage it better than others, but it still comes down to teaching everyone all the way down to young school children that this is the type of love you should be wanting, which is a bunch of strangers shouting your name. But when that stranger's, you know, you're up on stage, they shout, you know, we love you. Obviously, it rings hollow to you because you know they don't love you. They don't at all. Like, I get fan mail. I've sold enough books that I get fan mail. And they use words like that. It's like, if I had to come live at your house for 6 months for some reason, I assure you, you would, you, those are not the words you would be using. Like, you would be ready for me to leave when that's over. You would still read my books, but that love is a completely one-way thing. It's 1,000 people saying, I love you, and I don't have to do anything back other than do the stuff I'm doing anyway, which is write books. Or if, you know, you're a famous rapper, you got to keep rapping. But that's what you do. You're doing that anyway. You're doing it because you love it. So having 10,000 people say, I love you, Kanye, it's the kind of love where if those any of those people call you and ask you to come help them move, he's not going to be there to help you move your sofa. Where if you actually meet someone and they're your really good friend or they're your whatever, then yeah, that you're going to help that person do awful things. They're going to call you in the middle of the night, need you to come pick them up, you know, saying they got a flat tire. There's a give and take. There's a push and pull. They rely on you. There's a responsibility. When it's a mass of fans, it's one way. And that's why people think it's so great. It's a blowjob. It's you're not having to do anything. You just get to sit there and accept adoration. But until you get it, you don't realize how hollow it is. But in terms of like this being like a plague on the modern world, when you see surveys that show that, you know, the average kid's got like 800 friends on Facebook, but the average person has fewer social connections now than any time in the past when we've done, like the average person, I can't remember the stat, I quoted in one of my own articles, but the average person used to report having like an average of like 4 close friends. And now the average is like 1.2. And there's a solid quarter of the population who has none. We have many, many, many shallow social connections, but no close social connections. Well, that's a symptom of the narcissist. That's what they have. How many like really close confidants does Donald Trump have where that person can sit there and tell Donald, your hair looks stupid, or can call Donald
very clearly zero.
Can call Donald at 3 a.m. and say, look, dude, I'm in jail. I need you to come bail me out. I can't tell anybody. Like, no, I need you to come yourself. Like, how many people does he really have that connection with where he would go and like help them clean up vomit or go and really be there for them? Because he doesn't need that. He's put himself on a level where he's got an army of people that would do whatever he says. You know, the classic thing where you're surrounded by yes men or whatever. Well, that's a miserable place to be, but we're all there where I can go on Facebook and say, hey, it's my, or automatically says, hey, it's my birthday. And I personally will get like 250 happy birthday messages. But how many of those 250 people do I have to shop for a birthday gift for? When it's their birthday, none. It's like in my life, I have like 3 people I buy for. So what our social circles look like, it's almost like a, instead of like a ball, it's like a hollow ring or something. Like you're at the center and there's a bunch of people out at the outer edges of it. But in the middle where you really need to reach out and connect with people, there's nobody home.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was an episode of, since we're talking about WTF, I recently listened to an episode where Marc Maron interviewed Jason Segel, who's the writer of, I think, one of the funniest and most underrated comedies and the star of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And, you know, he did the Muppets movie and everything. And he was talking about, I think he was saying that he had been sober for a couple of years and that at a certain point, he just realized that there was nothing there, like exactly what you were saying, that like he got really famous, like he wrote Forgetting Sarah Marshall when he was 25. I heard that and I was like, man, that lucky son of, you know, like, wow, I would really love that. And then, you know, he eventually was like, yeah, and now I'm sober for a couple years because once I had everything that I wanted and had this great career, he just looked at his life one day and was like, Jesus, like I have no deep sense of well-being, and there was some alcoholism mixed in there. And you were talking about a sugar rush. It's the same thing. I think we had a past episode that people can go back and listen to if they want about addiction, and that does feel like a companion episode to this one because it's the same kind of machinery that is telling you that this thing will make you feel better. And fame is at the very end of whatever obstacle course that people are building for themselves. Like, fame is the ultimate goal, But in between, you know, it's these tiny little sugar rushes or whatever it is. And, you know, we talked about in that episode, we seem to be seeing a rise in addiction in America. And I think that it's not disconnected completely or really at all from what we're talking about, which is this bill of goods that we're sold, that this external goal is going to give you meaning, is going to replace the thing that humans need, which is close personal friendships.
So when you start talking about like how this affects like a new generation of people, I hate articles that are all like, well, you know, these millennials, it's the most narcissistic generation, because it's so condescending. And again, I think they mean it, they usually mean it in the insult version of the word rather than the clinical, hey, they're suffering from this. It always comes with this, like, well, in my day, I would go and work two jobs, and if I wanted to, you know, I wasn't too proud to flip burgers when I was your age. Let me say it, that, and this is coming for the millennials listening to this, this is coming from someone, you're not going to out narcissism me, so I'm not talking down to you here. The idea is, and I think there's some validity to it, this is going to lead into, you talked about like the housing crisis and all that. This is ties into that. If there's a young person just out of college and they're not taking a job because they don't want to work at Starbucks or they don't want to work at Burger King or whatever, the reason they don't want to work at Burger King or Starbucks has nothing to do with the pay. It has to do with they don't want to be seen working at Burger King or working at Starbucks, because it's bad for their brand. They would never express it this way, but it's like me flipping burgers, and it's not their fault. They've been raised to believe that that's shameful, where in any kind of a sane world, if you can do the work and if it's putting food on your table and if you realize that you've just got to get something on your resume until you hear back from the real job you're applying to, if you just need to be able to feed yourself until a job opens up in your field, then none of that should matter. If you can do it, if it's, you know, if you've got an aptitude for it, if you're good at packing, you know, boxes on a UPS truck or doing whatever. Like, I play into this too, because I will, when I'm trying to talk to like aspiring writers to like inspire them, I will say things like, well, when I was in my 30s, I was still working at an office, like doing data entry. Like, I'm trying to say to them, you know, don't get discouraged if you're not successful by 25. Like, I was 32 when I got this job at Crack. This first time I had ever gotten paid to write anything. You know, before that, I was, you know, like, I was applying for jobs in warehouses. I applied for a job at like the Postal Service and got turned down. It's like, you're not smart enough to do this, you know? And so also in the course of saying that, I'm putting it out there like that's a shameful thing. Well, here's the reality. At that office job that I had, that I keep talking about like it's the bad old days, A, not only do I have friends who still work there, B, when I left and my job opened up, I bet they got 150 applications for that job, because it came with health insurance. You were working indoors in the air conditioning on a computer. When I got that job, I was applying at freaking lawn care. Like, I would have taken anything. And so I was happy to have got it, because like, oh, this is indoors. I won't have to work out in the rain, you know, delivering stuff to people or whatever the other entry-level jobs are. So the idea is that a lot of the trouble that this next group of youth have with getting started in the job market, it's not that those entry-level jobs don't exist. It's that you've got managers and employers saying, I can't get these people to do these jobs. They show up for one day, then they leave, or worse, they do it like a hipster. They do the whole job with like a detached irony. Well, it's like, hi, isn't it hilarious that I'm... You know, that I'm making coffee, like, isn't it? It's like we're living in a sitcom. Like, instead of like throwing themselves into it and getting like really good at it and just, you know, being the best, that's like, well, I'm making coffee, but I'm no barista. Like, that's not who I am. And it still comes from this, like, being so scared to admit that, yeah, at this point in your life, you are a barista, and that's fine. But narcissism doesn't allow that. And I worry every time I use that word, I worry that people just hear it as dickhead. Like, well, these dickheads, they can't, you know, these egotistical jerks are too good. And no, it's something that happens to you. It's something you're raised with, and it's awful. It's not something like you should be deriding people for. You should be helping them get over it. But because they're suffering from it more than anybody else.
One thing that helped me conceptualize what narcissism is in my head was Dr. Drew Pinsky. He's the only doctor I really listen to. He's a doctor from Loveline. When he was hosting Loveline, every time they had a celebrity guest host on, he would ask them to take the narcissism personality test. And the thing he found is that the celebrities who had the highest scores were the reality stars, which in one respect, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. But in another, it's like they were crushing musicians. You know, you think that Mick Jagger is the biggest narcissist you could possibly think of. I think I've heard that before. But he has an actual skill that his self-esteem is connected to. And when you have a reason to esteem yourself, then there's not the desperation. There's not the hollowness at the middle of it. Mick Jagger is a fantastic songwriter. And so he wrote a bunch of those songs, and so he has a skill. So he isn't getting there on narcissism, whereas reality stars are desperately clawing their way onto TV because they don't have anything there. They don't have a reason to esteem themselves. They think that deep down they're defective. And I think the financial disaster that happened most recently, the movie The Big Short talks about what happened, and they show that, like, in the 70s, banking was this really boring profession where people would make handshake deals. You know, they were interested in retiring with their 401k. And at a certain point, they started inventing these products that added no value, but they added money. And a lot of the smartest people I know, when they graduated college, went and worked at hedge funds. And when you ask those people what value they're adding to the world, they don't have an answer. So it's this sort of idea that you are desperately clawing your way and, like, using these external indicators to sort of fill that hollow hole that only 1% of the people are supposed to have, but that, you know, externally, it seems like we're all building our own careers in the image of those people.
Well, and it's specifically about the housing thing where, you know, the whole thing with the subprime mortgages and people taking out mortgages they couldn't afford. Like, look at your life. If you truly didn't care about appearances, truly didn't care, how much could you really get by on? Like, if you just wanted a place to live that was warm in the winter and had a place to put your stuff, as opposed to a place that looked presentable when you bring friends or girls or boys over that you're trying to impress. Like, I wonder what percentage of the economy is based on this. Because the whole thing with houses, like, you see the houses rich people live in, and it's like one guy living in a house that has 48 rooms and 12 bathrooms. And it's like, well, obviously he's not going to invite 40 people to come live with him. It's an expression of his ego. Here is a sign of my success, this house. And, like, ever since I like, the last book deal I signed, I've been shopping for a car. I work from home. I don't commute anywhere. What am I going to do with a car? Like, I already have one that I don't drive. It's in the garage. It's like, what do I really want? Well, I want people to see me in something that represents, like, hey, I bet that guy got a book deal. And people will drive themselves infinitely into debt just in pursuit of that. And the whole theory was the enormous amount of debt and credit that people have, that a lot of that spending is, well, I should be living in a bigger house, or I should be wearing nicer clothes. Like, I have to present, even though I'm not making a lot of money, I need to at least appear to be, because, again, it's all about appearances. It's all about putting forward a certain look or whatever to make up for the fact that I don't really have this. But as long as I can make people think I do, you know, and see, we all know a guy who's got, like, a pretty nice car and lives in, like, a futon in his friend's one-bedroom apartment. Like, it's, they're channeling their resources toward appearing to be at a higher status than they are, because they've been taught that that status is all that matters. There's other people that blame the self-esteem movement in the 80s, like because with you know when you're worried about like teen suicide, things like that, teaching kids high self-esteem. Now, we had an article on the site that like that doesn't work because you're trying to tell kids you're awesome, you're great, you need to look at the mirror and tell yourself you're great, but they're not doing anything great. When what you should be teaching the kids to do is to make things, build things, learn a skill that they can be proud of. That's why, you know, sports is always such a big deal, because at least it's something they can go out and do, and they hit the ball. It's like, hey, I did it. I hit that ball. It's an accomplishment. And you as a human being are a machine built to take pride in doing things and growing things and catching things. And to try to take artificial pride in yourself, like no matter how many daily affirmations you say in the mirror, like you are good enough, you're strong enough, you're just by virtue of being born, that's true. Everyone has value, but you don't believe it. You say it all you want, you don't believe it. You don't believe in yourself because you haven't done anything worth believing in. You until you've done something that you can be proud of, you're not truly going to believe it. And I'm not saying you've got to become world famous, but you know, if some people take pride in growing their garden or whatever, but it's got to be something other than I'm really impressing. I impressed 27 strangers today. That's the sugar rush version of it that doesn't actually help you.
Yeah, you can't fool yourself. And that's sort of what the entire narcissism, self-esteem Ponzi scheme, that's why I called it that, is because it's this idea that if you just add enough sort of external indicators that you will finally be like, ah, there it is. Now we're good. And it just doesn't happen. And I think we're at a point where a lot of people come to a point in their lives where they realize that pretty late. I don't know. This sounds like the sort of bullshit that I usually rail against, where it's like things used to be better. But it does seem like people are pretty profoundly disconnected from that idea of sort of building self-esteem by making yourself worthy of esteem. Maybe the ultimate narcissistic act, and when they interview spree shooters who don't kill themselves, having narcissistic personality disorder is basically a constant. And when you think about it, that is the ultimate sort of exercise of what we're talking about, wanting to put yourself in front of other people without doing anything of worth. And you can put yourself in front of lots and lots of people on CNN by doing something that actually completely takes away any worth that you thought you ever had. And that seems like something that is increasing more and more. And I don't think I ever had a real theory on why that was the case until really kind of thinking through this idea that we're evolving in a more and more narcissistic direction. You know a lot about narrative stuff. I'm wondering if it feels like, you know, the hero's journey is something that has existed for a long time. But the fact that all movies now are a remake of the original Star Wars, where like a nobody from nowhere is discovered and finds out that they're the most important person in the universe and goes on a journey. It seems like we're evolving more and more in that direction. Now it's like Harry Potter, The Matrix is that plot. I wonder, are we seeing more of that hero's journey where you identify with some central character who's kind of vanilla? And that's an interesting thing that people wonder why Keanu Reeves has a career. It's because he is easy to project yourself onto because he does not emote. So you can just project your emotions onto his completely blank slate of a face. That's what makes The Matrix so effective, is you can just put yourself in his position and experience the joy of learning, oh, the world is a simulation and you are the most important person in the world. It's almost like narcissism to the point of solipsism in the case of The Matrix, which solipsism is like believing you're the only person who exists. But do you think that is increasing, or has it just always existed?
Well, you're touching on cultural mythology, and that touches on to religion, because I've always believed that one of the roles of religion is a hedge against humans' tendency toward narcissism or just selfishness. Because ultimately, a narcissist, even if you rewind several thousand years, they can't conceive of themselves as part of the tribe, right? Like they can't conceive that what they do has actions on. They only think in terms of, like, this is the person who, if they wanted to go out and do something and it's raining, they're angry. They're angry at the universe for raining on, like, never mind the fact that it's raining on everyone. Never mind the fact that it's watering the crops. Like, they only see it as a personal inconvenience to them. So I've always felt like part of what organized religion has done, all of them have done, is try to reprogram a human brain out of that mode of thinking by saying, no, ultimately you're subservient to a higher power who has ultimate power over you. That higher power can ultimately dictate what your fate is, you know, that you are powerless to affect, like whether you'll be reincarnated as this, whether you'll go to heaven or hell. And this higher power has said to you, you need to make yourself subservient to others. You need to be a servant. When you pray, you need to lay down on the mat and put your face to the ground. You need to totally humiliate yourself. And obviously, a narcissist, like, you can watch a televangelist and they've just twisted that around to say, yeah, God has designated me as the best person in the world. You should all give me your money because God came down and said, I'm the center of the universe. So there's still room to twist it around. But I've always felt like that indoctrination from a young age on, whatever else you feel that you may, you know, especially among our listeners, whatever they may hate about religion in terms of, you know, superstition or being anti-science or, you know, being anti-woman or whatever, the reason it's there and the good thing that it's to do is to try to keep being a daily reminder that when you do something wrong, it's not just about how it looks to other people. That even if there was no one to see you do it, you internally need to feel bad about it because God is watching. Whereas the narcissist only cares about reputation, right? Like, they only care about getting caught because they're only worried about how it hurts their public image. And so as a culture, I think for a long, long time, even after the culture started to change, I think most people still had some kind of a guidepost. And the heroes in that type of mythology tends to be about self-sacrifice, right? Like they went out there and it doesn't matter if you're talking about, you know, a Christ-like figure or if you're talking about the 300 Spartans. It's like when something bad was about to happen, they went out, laid their life down on the line, and if something bad happens tomorrow, you're expected to do the same because ultimately it's the group that matters, not you. You're expected to lay yourself down to save the others. It seems like when you change the story so that that character like always survives at the end or becomes like a god at the end, it's a different deal. Now it's like there's a threat and only you can stop it because you are super, super awesome. There's a great rant by one of the South Park guys, I think Trey Parker, talking about Michael Bay movies and how Michael Bay movies are always so hilarious because they take that hero's journey. And the hero's journey in a Michael Bay movie is like this muscular guy in a tight t-shirt saying, I am awesome. And then they have a crisis halfway through the movie where they think, maybe I'm not awesome. And then in the third act, it's like, no, I am awesome. You're right. I was right before. I was awesome all along. It's like that's the journey, and it's like it leaves you walking out of the theater like, yeah, that's right. The egomaniac, the cocky egomaniac who's pushing the nerd around, it turns out in the end he's right.
Like Harry Potter, instead of sacrificing himself for the good of mankind, beats Voldemort and retires like a professional athlete who, you know, he retires and everybody in the wizarding world is like, man, Harry Potter sure is the reason we're still alive. He's the best. And in The Matrix, he doesn't sacrifice himself, right? He just still insists on like everybody coming to terms with reality.
And, well, no, in the end of the third movie, they do this weird thing where he like merges with The Matrix in like this brilliant ball of light, and it's not clear what happens, but it's sort of, he like, it's literally like a ball of light that like shoots out beams in the shape of a cross. It's subtle. It's not as subtle as Zack Snyder symbolism.
As the part where Superman is standing in front of a stained glass window with Jesus's picture on it in one scene. And yeah, but I wonder like the new Bourne movie. So the Bourne movie start with Matt Damon is like floating somewhere in an ocean and like doesn't know who he is, and then like suddenly finds that he has these crazy abilities, you know. And the original Star Wars was like he was a moisture farmer, he's like a poor farm boy. But like now the new Bourne movie, it appears that Jason Bourne is just like the world's greatest cage fighter somewhere. Like that appears to be the status quo. Like it seems like we're sort of evolving in the direction of the Michael Bay movie, where it's like Jason Bourne is awesome. Hold on, Jason Bourne's awesome, right? Jason Bourne is awesome. Like that's going to be the journey that we go through on the next movie.
Well, and like you bring up Harry Potter, and like the crisis in that is that people doubt him. And the like in the third and fourth books and movies, people start to say, well, you know, he claims Voldemort's back, but, you know, he's just a kid. And then sure enough, in the end, it turns out he's 100% right, right? And so that's a lot of it. And like even in the new Star Wars, like the first scene, you know, is like the, what's the female's name?
Finn?
No, that's the
Rey.
Right. It's
wait,
like
he's not a female.
It's like in the beginning, like the heroes, you know, he's getting chewed at by his boss, the stormtrooper. She's getting chewed at by the merchant who won't sell her, who won't give her enough money for parts she collects. In both cases, like their value is not being recognized. It's like, see, the world doesn't right. know how awesome you are, but you'll have a chance to rise to the occasion. And it's like seizing that moment. It's about like the world realizing you're awesome against, you know, when all your doubters, you know, all your haters were. And I know the disaster movies all have this too, like Independence Day. It's like only Jeff Goldblum is smart enough to realize the aliens are planning to invade, even though it seems fairly obvious when they showed up what they're doing. And then it, like by the end, there has to be that moment where the authorities all realize, you know, you're right all along. The Adam Sandler movie where he's in a video game or whatever, it's the same deal. Like he's a loser and a schlub, and eventually all the military generals and the president have to come groveling to him like, no, we need your help, Adam Sandler. Only you can kill Pac-Man. Or, well, I only saw it briefly on my TV.
The interesting thing about Star Wars, I had never really thought about Finn as a employee whose value is not being appreciated, because I think Cracked columnist Joshua Sargent pointed out on the site that he immediately goes from being a clumsy stormtrooper who is like, man, I should not be a stormtrooper because what we're doing is evil, but I've, you know, been put in this really difficult position. And like, so he escapes and he immediately starts shooting stormtroopers who were like, very recently, his coworkers who were also in the exact same situation as him were people who had from birth been trained to be killers. So it's almost like a disgruntled employee going on a shooting spree. I kind of wish that Harry Potter had ended with him being just going around and like gruesomely killing all the people who doubted him. That doesn't happen, does it? I didn't watch the movies.
No, but I've read the entire Harry Potter series like 3 times, so I don't want listeners to think that I'm crapping on Harry Potter as like this dumb thing for the commoners that has corrupted the children. Harry Potter has maybe the best resolution of a like hero and like his personal tormentor storyline I've ever seen. Because in that story, you have the hero Harry Potter, and he enters school at age 11, and he immediately meets the blonde-haired, mean kid, Draco Malfoy, who's like torments him, bullies him, tries to kill him 6 or 7 times, because it's in that universe where the kids just try to murder each other. And then it's just forgotten like the next week. And the book ends, the final book ends, taking place like 20 years later. And all of these kids are now grown up, and they're taking their kids off to that train station to send their kids off to magic school, which is actual. They learn actual magic. If you haven't read the books, they're not like learning how to do card tricks, because that would be incredibly sad. And his resolution with Draco, his bully, his nemesis, is he looks over and Draco's over there dropping his kid off, and they just sort of tersely nod to each other, and that's it. Because in real life, I'm telling you, the bullies you had as a teenager, like, they don't, like, get their comeuppance. Like, you just sort of, you all get old, and you move on, and you get married, and you have your own kids, and one day you'll run into that person, and you'll just sort of nod at each other, and that's it. Like, that's the most true thing in a book about wizards. That was, like, one of the most genuine moments, because every other author would have had some big moment where that kid like really gets what's coming to him and he falls into a volcano or whatever. And she resisted that. Like, no, it's like he learned his lesson. You know, like a lot of the evil wizards got arrested, but he was too young, and he kind of, everybody's moved on. That's what it was. That was great. And I do want to get into Star Wars spoilers very briefly, because it's going to help make our point. If you've not seen the new Star Wars movie yet, you surely have already heard that this happens. if you have not, go ahead and stop listening, I guess, for a while. But in the new Star Wars, they cram Han Solo into the story. Harrison Ford clearly doesn't want to be there. He made them pay him he had to be paid $35 million. True, that's a true amount. $35 million to be in the movie. He did not want to do it. He clearly hates acting. He's like, just kind of reads his lines and kind of does the quips or whatever. It's very sad. He's very old, and it's like clearly hard for him to get around. And then he dies. He dies like halfway through the movie. We mentioned on the Star Wars podcast, Han Solo was supposed to die in Return of the Jedi. And someone wrote, Tony Zhou, I think is like Z-H-O-W, wrote a great essay about this, saying that would have been a good character arc for Han Solo, because you meet him, he's an arrogant bastard, he's a narcissist, only cares about himself. Over the course of the three movies, he develops these personal connections with the Rebels, with Luke and Leia, gets drawn into their cause, and then by the final movie is taking a very dangerous mission down to this planet with the teddy bears on it to do this dangerous thing to let the rebellion succeed. And then the final finishing that arc should be him sacrificing himself, because it completes the arc from narcissist to total self-sacrifice for the larger cause. He finally gives up himself completely, and that's Han Solo. That's a guy who goes from being an arrogant dick where it's me, 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 to finally losing himself completely for the greater cause so that the entire galaxy can be free. George Lucas famously did not want to do this because, again, he thought that that would hurt merchandise sales or traumatize children. So, in the new movie, in order to complete what should have been his character arc, they have to freaking take this character and restart his arc. They have to make him a smuggler again, make him single again, make him a loner again. He is inexplicably completely detached from Leia, from the rebellion, from Luke. He's now out just smuggling exactly where he was when they met him in A New Hope. He's a smuggler on a junkie ship running, I think it's methamphetamine is what they said he's smuggling across the galaxy. Then
think about that, people who watch the movie. There's no good reason why he's not with Leia. They don't explain that. It's just this vague, like, emotional chilliness where they're like, she doesn't want to be with me, but she does, and they're in love with each other. There's no reason that he's off by himself just cruising the galaxy dealing meth.
So they have to have the whole arc again, where he has to be talked into joining again, has to be talked into helping the rebellion again, and then finally, halfway through the movie, he agrees to go down to the planet, just like in Jedi, to plant some bombs, just like in Jedi, only this time he's actually going to do the thing he was supposed to do there, which is sacrifice himself so his friends can get away. He goes down there and meets the main bad guy, and goes down there, and then he dies and he sacrifices himself, and he has, well, that whole thing is in there because he gets the proper arc he should have had before. When you take that death out of the arc, again, it's simply a story of a very arrogant narcissist. And the lesson he needs to learn is that, you know what, we actually need you to use your super awesomeness to help us. And then once he uses it to help them, it's like, all right, now you win a medal. Like, it's like, see, you used your awesomeness to help us, and it came with great rewards. You got the girl, you got the medal, you got everything you wanted. And it's like, no, that's the opposite of how they used to teach it. It used to be, you need to get over your narcissism and sacrifice yourself. Well, what does Han Solo sacrifice? I guess the idea is that he could be out like making money as a smuggler, but you don't see him being like poor or giving up anything. Like, he gets captured by Darth Vader briefly in Empire Strikes Back, but that's the sort of thing that probably happened to him all the time as a smuggler. Like, so it's an important distinction. It really is. I have one movie viewing recommendation. Have you ever seen the movie My Dinner with Andre?
No.
It's a
about Andre the Giant?
Yes, it's about... No, it's a 1970s movie that is famous because it's a movie that takes place in real time between two guys who are eating a meal for the course of the 90 minutes or whatever. One of the guys is the bald guy from The Princess Bride. Yeah, another guy's a famous actor. The movie is famous because it's, when people see a really boring movie, they're like, ah, it's like My Dinner with Andre, because it's famous for literally being a dinner between two people. Like, they don't leave that restaurant. And like in The Simpsons, there was a joke where they, at the arcade game, the only vacant game was the My Dinner with Andre game. And it was like, you have these two characters sitting at a table and you have to like trade witticisms back and forth. I finally want to, the whole thing's on YouTube, I'm sure illegally, but it's there's nobody out there patrolling the copyright of My Dinner with Andre, I assure you. Obviously, the movie is not watching two people eat for 90 minutes. That would be hilarious, but that's not what it is. The movie is a conversation two people are having. And specifically, one guy is a playwright, and he goes to have dinner with a friend of his who, the story he got was that the friend had went nuts, had left the country and had joined a commune or something. So the setup for the movie is that he had been avoiding dinner with this guy for like a year because it's like, I don't want to go listen to this guy try to talk me into being a Hare Krishna or whatever the hell he was doing. But he finally gets roped into talking to him, and the movie is the conversation they have. And you learn over the course of this conversation why the guy went nuts. And the reason he went nuts is what we've been talking about on this podcast today. He says, you watch the news. They're talking to a terrorist. And that guy looks like a terrorist. Like, he's dressed like a terrorist. That guy got up in the morning and dressed in a manner that would be acceptable to the other terrorists. So the thing that broke his brain was the idea that everything you do is based on what other people expect you to do. Other people only expect you to do those things because other people expect them to expect you to do those things. In other words, if you showed up at work tomorrow wearing nothing but like a leopard skin G-string, the first person who would be alarmed by it would be alarmed because if they don't say anything, if they think it's cool, then they're also an outcast. So this guy had left after like his marriage broke up because he realized he's like, nothing me and my wife were saying to each other was what we really felt. And I realized I didn't even know this person. We were just performing a marriage. That's why the characters are both like playwrights, because they deal in theater. And he's like, I realized it's all theater. Everything we do is theater. And so he went to try to figure out like, what should a human life be? Like, if I really didn't care what people thought of me, you're putting on pants because society says you have to wear pants. It's the first thing you do, you know, you get up, you know, you take a shower because society says if you don't take a shower this number of times a week, you stink and then you're a social outcast. Like, if you truly didn't worry about that stuff, what would you be doing with your life? What would you be thinking? What would you be? So it's very much worth watching, because I watched it because I thought it would be ridiculous. I thought it'd be 90 minutes, these two people eating. And I found it fascinating because like every 5 minutes there was a new insight I was hearing. And that's why they made the movie, because they just wanted to film these two people talking through this idea. And it's somebody in the late 70s seeing this coming, seeing the world changing and talking about it. So that's what I would leave you with.
Yeah, it came out in 1981. Okay. So start your summary of it over again with the right date. That sounds actually really good. Yeah, I had a similar thought to that when I was in college, and I talked to a friend of mine who was really smart, and I was like, have you ever thought that this is all like, it's almost like self-surveillance where you're keeping yourself in line based on what society tells you your expectations were? And he said that it was a really narcissistic thought. And I do think you're right, that they're both really like purely external ideas based on keeping up appearances. They start from the premise of I'm doing things completely for how they appear to the outside world and not based on any sort of inner life.
Well, and if you want to see the funniest examples of this, look at people who choose to drop out of society. Like, the whole concept of a biker gang is that, like, we don't obey society's rules. We're totally going to live in a manner that is outside. We're true outlaws. Everything society says, we recognize it as all artificial. So to show that we're nonconformists, we are going to dress exactly alike. Not only all ride the same vehicle, but the same brand. We're going to adhere to a strict color code, a strict type of decoration, a strict type of bandana, strict. We all wear the same brand of shoes. It's like, you know, yeah, I don't care what anybody thinks. I am now going to devote the rest of my life to maintaining an image of a biker. And I'm going to wake up every day worried that I don't have the right type of beard to be a biker. And that maybe I need to, like, should I diet? Like, should I? I have broken free from your expectations, and this is how I'm doing it.
Yeah, that would be amazing if we just had, like, hidden cameras behind everyone's mirrors, and we could see how long bikers actually spend looking at their beards in the morning and get an actual comparison between, like, bikers and reality stars. By the way, I do think you just hit on a pay dirt idea, which is just like really colorful biker gang gear. Or at least I thought that, and then I realized that was just the Vanilla Ice movie.
Cool as ice. Right. Yeah.
Crush a bit, little bit, roll it up, take a hit, feeling lit, feeling right, 2 a.m. summer night. I don't care, hand on the wheel, driving drunk, I'm doing my thing, rolling the mid beside him now, living my life, getting out dreams. People told me.
All right, that was our conversation. We're listening to Pursuit of Happiness by Kid Cudi, which is a song that talks about, you guessed it, pursuing happiness, but using some of the methods we discussed in today's episode. Great song. Hope you enjoy it. On to some footnotes. Jason talked about Trump wanting to send us to war because of a personal insult and feeling insulted, and we kept also bringing up Hitler, and it's probably worth noting that Germany started invading people and partially started World War II in response to nationwide humiliation. They'd just lost the most awful war ever, and the rest of Europe was still holding their head down, farting on them, and you know, they just snapped. Hitler appealed to Germany's sense of wounded pride. I talked about narcissism being part of Keanu Reeves' continued ability to get leading roles in movies. There was this show, a live show for a while, I think out here, maybe in New York, where this comedy troupe did a reenactment of Point Break. I think we've talked about it on a past episode, where they pulled someone from the audience in to play the Johnny Utah role. Which is a brilliant idea, and I think encapsulates what Keanu's purpose is in that movie and most movies. To be a blank slate we can project ourselves onto. Regarding Trump and Kanye, first of all, if you're listening to this years from now, the reason we keep bringing them up is because they're both having enormous moments right now. Trump is surging to be the basic odds-on favorite to win the Republican nomination, and Kanye is averaging an internet breaking meltdown and subsequent meme every day for like the past 10 days. Anyways, reading that Trump New Yorker profile from 1997, he's like constantly bombarding the writer with all these facts about how rich he is, how great he is, how much real estate he owns. It's surreal. It's like he's a machine for regurgitating facts about how great Donald Trump is. And the writer is fact-checking each of these claims and quietly explaining why a lot of them aren't entirely true in retrospect. But the story follows Trump. I think in one part, he takes this Russian oligarch through this hall where he has like Shaq's signed sneaker and a signed boxing glove from Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, and like brags about how they're close personal friends of his. And after the guy leaves, he turns to the writer and just like kind of quietly muses to himself, "It's a pretty cool life I have, isn't it?" Which is hilarious. Like, who says that? But then I was thinking that it reminded me of one of my favorite stories about Kanye that Dave Chappelle told on The Tonight Show, where Kanye performed on The Chappelle Show, like, before he was even famous, when his first album had just come out. And, you know, Chappelle didn't really know who he was, but he heard he was pretty talented, so he let him come into the editing bay and watch some upcoming sketches that hadn't come out yet. And at one point, Kanye's phone rings and he picks up and he's like, "I can't talk right now. No, I can't talk. I'm in the edit of Chappelle Show watching sketches no one's ever seen before because my life is dope and I do dope shit," and hung up on whoever the person was who was calling him. And I love that story, and it kind of always made me love Kanye, and I assume that that's sort of what people who love Trump see in him as well. But At the same time, with regards to both of them, who takes a step back and is like, first of all, I have pretty cool life, and then says it to everyone around them. That's hilarious, but I guess very strange behavior. Anyways, like I said, you can find, I really recommend these pictures of Hitler rehearsing his speech in front of a mirror in 1925. They're just hilarious, and he's very clearly like the first PR genius, which is interesting and a side of Hitler that you don't often see. There's also a really great picture of him in like really short shorts and lederhosen posing next to a tree in the forest that you should also check out, because he was a very vain person. The Jason Segel episode of WTF is actually not online anymore, but if you sign up for HAL, you can get the entire WTF archive for free. How's that for some native advertising? The full version of My Dinner with Andre is on YouTube, and yeah, highly recommend that. I actually haven't watched it yet, but I will, and then I'll highly recommend that. The psychiatrist that Jason's always quoting writes at thelastpsychiatrist.com. Yeah, he's a really great writer. He writes in sort of a dialectic method, and it's really entertaining and endearing. There's a medium.com article by Tony Zhu called The Force Awakens is a Deeply Broken Film Because One Character Shouldn't Be There. So we'll link all of these things on the Cracked page that this podcast appears on, and also in the description on SoundCloud, and we'll try and provide the links in the description of the episode on iTunes. I don't know if that's even possible, though. But anyways, that's been our episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Oh, and I almost forgot that we have a live podcast coming up March 9th, Wednesday at 7 p.m. It's going to be the last Wednesday live show, and then we'll be moving to Saturdays. But this is going to be a great one. We're going to pit dog people versus cat people and tell you all sorts of interesting information, like, did you know that cats modeled their meow after the cries of human babies because they knew humans care about that noise? Or that dogs can read your mind emotionally better than you can read other human beings? Anyways, that's what we're talking about in the next live episode of the Crack Podcast. I'm hosting. We're going to have Daniel O'Brien there, Alex Schmidt, Carmen Angelica, and Jake Weissman, who you might know as just a very funny stand-up and from Twitter. And yeah, so it's at the UCB Sunset Theater on Wednesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. Tickets are only $6 and they're still available. So jump on them now. We've always sold out, so you really need to get on them soon-ish. And that's been our episode. Thanks to engineer Brett Rader, who you can follow on Twitter at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then. I'm on the pursuit of happiness, and I know everything is shining on. Always go. I'll be fine once I get it. I'll be good. Good.
wingspan. That. Zuli, wait.
Oh my God, why did I drink so much and smoke so much?
Guys, today's show was sponsored by Howl.fm. That's Howl.fm. Talk about burying the lead, guys. I just found this out. Apparently, Howl now has the first 30 episodes of Super Ego on Howl Premium. If you aren't familiar with Super Ego, it's the funniest podcast ever. It's like improvised, but then they cut it down to just the funniest parts. And the improvisers are Matt Gourley, Jeremy Carter, Mark McConville, and Paul F. Tompkins. Matt Gourley has actually been on the podcast before. So yeah, that is reason alone to get Howl Premium. You get all of that for only $4.99 a month. And with promo code CRACKED, C-R-A-C-K-E-D, you get a full month free trial. That's howl.fm and use promo code CRACKED, cracked, for a 1 month free trial of Howl Premium. I'm going to go listen to the first 30 episodes of Super Ego.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Pardo from the Never Not Funny podcast. Hey, listen, coming up on March 5th, it's our annual Pardcast-a-thon. That is the 12-hour version of Never Not Funny, hosted by myself, Matt Belknap, and Pat Francis. We have a different guest on every 20 minutes to a half hour this year, including Doug Benson, Scott Aukerman, Paul F. Tompkins, Sarah Silverman, and over 20 more. We are raising money for Smile Train, the great organization that goes to third world countries to fix the cleft lips and cleft palates of people that couldn't otherwise afford that surgery. It changes a person's life. You can watch it live at nevernotfunny.com on March 5th between 12 noon and midnight Pacific time. Watch and donate. I thank you for your time.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.